a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, and thank you for being here, and thank you to those of you who are joining us on the line. Just a reminder to those of you on the phone during the question and answer period to mute your phone by pressing star 6 and unmute by pressing pound 6. And a reminder to use the microphones on the table for those of you in the room. And with that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Thank you, Kelsey, and thank you, everyone, for joining for this press conference. I thought I'd lead off by talking a little bit about the National Governors Association meeting, which I attended last weekend. Left 5:30 a.m. on Friday and got out to D.C. A little bit around noon hour because we wanted to spend some time before the NGA meeting officially began. We spent with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which is involved in transmission of electricity and also involved in gas pipelines. And I'm the currently the chair of the Governor's Wind Coalition. And so we wanted to talk with FERC a little bit about transmission issues and wind power. And so we had a nice meeting with them. Because of open meeting requirements, they couldn't, all four of them, meet with us as a group because that would require public notice and so on. So we met with a couple of them just to hear from them, and then we met with the other two to hear from them. The following day, Saturday, we're pleased at a plenary session to hear from the CEO of General Electric, who talked about General Electric's business worldwide and the areas where they were going to be focusing in the near future. He talked about gas generation equipment. And I don't have my notes right in front of me from that meeting, but he was a very interesting person to listen to and certainly a leader of the largest industrial company in America, if not the world. We also had a meeting with the Energy Commission or Economic Development Committee, which focused on the reauthorization of the transportation bill at the federal level. The Federal Transportation Act, which expired about 3 years ago, then was extended in short continuing resolution time spans for periods of months at a time, and then finally reauthorized for a little over 2 years. That 2 year plus 27-month period is expiring this September 30th. And it is not only problematic because the transportation bill is expiring, but it also comes at about the time when the Federal Highway Trust Fund will run out of money. The Highway Trust Fund is, of course, largely funded by federal gas taxes, and the outlays from the transportation fund have been outstripping the income and drawing that balance gradually lower and lower, and the balance will reach zero around the end of August or sometime in September, about when the act expires. So, of course, the states are interested in what the federal government will be doing, and there was a fair amount of conversation, a fair amount of conversation at the meeting, both in that context and in other meetings about urging the Congress to find a means to both enact a multi-year transportation bill and find a solution to the underfunding, which is around $15 billion a year, I believe, is the gap between expenditures and revenue. On Sunday, we met with we had a plenary meeting with Maria Bartiromo, who is a television personality involved in the business world, and she moderated a session about workforce, which was very interesting. And then we also, as governors in a governors only meeting, met with Ben Bernanke, the recently retired chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he talked about the economy and was careful, of course, to remind us that he now was a private citizen and no longer represented the opinions of the Reserve in any way, and these were his own personal opinions and attitudes. The governors then met Monday morning in a governors-only meeting. We talked about transportation again, as I mentioned. It was interesting to me that some states are less able to manage their cash flows than South Dakota. I think South Dakota is more cautious and responsible in managing its cash, because if you look at a highway program or highway project, the contractors are always paid first with state dollars. We use our own money to pay for projects as they are due payments, and then we seek reimbursement from the Federal Highway Trust Fund for the share that the federal government would be covering. And so there was some concern by some states that, gee, what if we're making payments in in September or October and there's no federal reimbursement available? How can we make those payments? And so apparently there's some limited ability of some of the states to float the federal government's slow reimbursement or late reimbursement potential. And I'm pleased to note that South Dakota does not have that difficulty. We have always managed our federal funds in such a way that we don't count on them immediately. We don't need them within the week to make our checkbook balance. And there are some states that are not in that position. They tread the line a little more closely, I guess. We also talked in our governor's only meeting about a concern that all of the states shared about the proposals from the Secretary of Defense to make cuts. The Budget Sequestration and the Budget Control Act, both of those pieces of legislation require Secretary Hagel and the President to propose budgets that include cuts to defense. And I think it's probably the citizens would see that as appropriate, given we ramped up quite a bit as we entered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and as we ramp down from those wars, should the defense budget be brought back to something below the levels that they attained during the peaks of those wars? And just to give you a sense of the Army National Guard impacts, I think I've got that detail in front of me here. Well, maybe not. I'm sorry. I thought I brought that along with me. The concern is that the National Guard grew, as I recall, from about 350,000 Army National Guard troops to about 358,000. So relatively small growth, a couple percent, roughly, and versus the regular Army grew considerably more than that. And the cuts that are being proposed are disproportionately impacting the Army National Guard as opposed to the regular Army. The regular Army will remain above pre-9/11 levels, whereas the National Guard, Army National Guard nationwide, will be cut below pre-9/11 levels. And I think the states felt that this was inappropriate, especially when you consider that the cost of a Army National Guard troop is about a third of the cost of a regular Army soldier. So I know the Secretary has to make judgments about readiness and the time that it takes to get some National Guard troops up to response times, and so I'm sure that'll be a factor that is included in that calculation. But again, if our readiness was proportional and appropriate pre-9/11, then the question is, should it return to those relative proportions or not? The governors also spent some time talking about Medicaid And I must say that this year's meeting of the governors was the most collegial meeting that I've attended in the years that I've been attending this gathering. In years past, especially when it comes to Medicaid expansion questions, there was a fair amount of divisiveness and partisanship demonstrated at some of those meetings, which I think was counterproductive. And so I think this year there was a deliberate effort to focus on things that unite us rather than those things that divided us. Among them was Medicaid, because there are some aspects of Medicaid that the governors do agree upon, and we presented a document to the president and to Secretary Sebelius that addressed some of those things. And I'll just give you one example. There are waivers. One can, as a state, apply for waivers where you seek to depart from the norm in the way that a Medicaid program is implemented in one state. And you go through quite a application process and exchange of information between the state and the federal government, and you establish some outcome goals that are intended to be attained as a consequence of the waiver. The federal government grants the waiver if they support the concept. And then after a period of time, there's a measurement and a determination made whether or not the waiver produced the outcomes that were intended. And the problem that many of the states agreed was a problem is that if state A applied for and went through this lengthy process to obtain a waiver and then demonstrated that they did in fact achieve the results they intended, then they had to renew the eligibility for that waiver again and again and again over succeeding years. And so the question was raised, why must we go through a full-blown application for a waiver that's already demonstrated its worthiness? Moreover, if state A has demonstrated the worthiness of a waiver approach, not only should state A not have to apply again and again and again to continue that program, but state B should be able to take it whole cloth from state A and implement it in state B if it makes sense in their state as well. So that's one example where the bureaucracy at this time impairs a state's ability to be flexible, to achieve economies and achieve improvements, and because bureaucracy is in the way of it. So we met about that, and I must say that when you leave the White House after that governor's only meeting with the president, I had a couple of meetings that I'll mention in a minute. So I went straight to the car, and other governors, you know, go straight to the car to get a plane. But a number of governors will always move over to the press corps, and I have not seen any of the reports or any of the YouTube videos of those press corps comments, but I think from what I heard from others is the portrayal in those after-meeting comments gave the impression of contentiousness in the room when the governors met with the president, and that was not the case at all. All the questions were very respectful and not hardball at all. I think there was good dialogue on a variety of issues, and I'll just recite some of the issues that we did talk about. We talked about Venezuela, Medicare cuts, flood insurance premiums, Medicaid report by the governors I just talked about. We talked about Trans-Canada Pipeline, government regulations in general, and, of course, the National Guard, as I mentioned earlier. So that's just a sum of the issues. We talked about others as well. And I thought it was a good meeting with the president, and I was glad that we were given that opportunity. After the meeting with the president, then I had arranged for two meetings at the Pentagon with Air Force personnel. I met with General James Jones, who is the Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff, about the airspace.
When did that just happen? I got your email, and I've been following it.
I think there's someone on the line.
Make sure your phones are muted. We can hear somebody. Reminder to press *6 to mute your phone.
As I was saying, after the meeting with the president, I met with General James Jones, the Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and our conversation was about the Powder River, training space that is that the Air Force has been proposing to expand. And that proposal has been in the works since, I think, 2008 or so. It's been quite a long time evolving, and part of the delay in getting that approved, I think, arises from turnover. You know, the base commander changes every 2 years. People get promoted. The presidency changes, and different people get appointed. And so I think it really does take some continued persistence from others to keep this sort of thing moving forward. But we had a very good meeting, and we are working hard to encourage the expansion of that Air Force practice space, because it is so close in proximity to Ellsworth Air Force Base that the travel time of the bombers to that space, where they would not drop live ammunition, they just practice using emitters and fake bombs, I guess. But the travel time is so short, and the fuel used is comparatively small as compared to what you would need to use to travel to Las Vegas training ranges and other training ranges currently used. It would be a big plus on the side of Ellsworth in its ability to stay off a future BRAC list. And coincidentally, you may know that Secretary Hagel's budget proposals, or maybe in other information, it came out that the proposal is to have the next BRAC in 2017. And so we want to work toward things like the expansion of that training airspace and avoiding non-compliant uses around the base in the accident potential zones, trying to remove non-compliant uses like trailer houses where people are willing to sell and interested in selling. Those kinds of things are all important toward preserving South Dakota as a very good place for Ellsworth to be, and the tremendous impact on our state that it has. The second meeting was about the Ellsworth Authority and the steps we've been taking locally to beyond the airspace. This second meeting was with Deputy Secretary Tim Bridges. He's involved in installations and environments that the Air Force occupy. And we pointed out that we're saving Ellsworth Air Force Base by building a wastewater treatment facility that Ellsworth will begin using this year. It will save them $250,000 annually. It's a wastewater treatment plant that the Air Force and Box Elder will both share, and that'll improve the environmental a situation that both wastewater treatment plants are out of compliance, so they both have to build new. And this way, we build a combined treatment facility. It will save a lot of money. It'll be cheaper to build one rather than two smaller ones. It'll be cheaper to operate for both entities. So we pointed that out. We also helped build a mock training village in the existing airspace that the Powder River training area comprises right now. We bought some old containers, you know, that you would use for shipping, and configured them in a way that looked like a village that you might overfly in Afghanistan or other areas where we're in conflict. And you can install electronic emitters that create the same electronic signature that other weapon systems would create. And we use National Guard troops during their training sessions to build this village. And Ellsworth has already used it 50 times since it was constructed. And we estimate that saved them about $1 million in gas, being able to use that facility rather than, again, one some distance away. We talked about some other things, too, about how the Ellsworth Authority is trying to be a good partner and encourage the Air Force to see South Dakota as wanting to do whatever we can to continue South Dakota as a good place for the Ellsworth Air Force Base. We got done with those meetings about 5:30 or so and got out of D.C. about 7 through the traffic and got home about 1:30 a.m. So, that's a little bit of that, and now I've been a bit windy, but hopefully you have questions about the session or other things that you'd like answered. Maybe start within the room, yeah. Kelsey?
Yeah, Governor, I guess the question would be, have you heard anything from Health and Human Services about the request for the waiver on Medicaid expansion?
No, I haven't. I did see Secretary Sebelius across the room when we were meeting with the president, but I didn't feel like when he was talking I should get up and walk over there to talk to her, so I did not get a chance. And as I said, I didn't know that she'd be there, but when we got done with the president, I had to dash to one of these meetings.
All right, a follow-up question. Some of the Republican legislative leaders said even if you don't get an answer by the end of session, your administration could go ahead, if the waiver is granted, your administration could go ahead and make an expansion after the legislative session ends, and legislative approval really wouldn't be necessary, at least until the budget had to be amended midway through the next year. Is that your reading of the situation?
You know, that's a pretty fair representation. In South Dakota, the process has been the amendment of our Medicaid plan has been through executive action, but of course it always has been constrained by the legislature's ability to fund it and willingness to fund it. So I'm sure it would take some time to amend the plan in a way that agreed with the proposals outlined in my letter, and then it would take some time to come into effect, and then we'd have to judge whether or not the budget as it existed for Medicaid was sufficient to allow that. And again, in the early years, remember that Medicaid payments under an expansion, if paid at the expansion rate proposed by the Affordable Care Act, would be 100%, and so it would be more administrative costs and other kinds of incidental costs that would be borne by the state, and probably the federal or the state budget could manage that. Of course, when the federal or when the legislature came back, they would have to amend the budget to allow for more federal fund expenditure authority. And so I guess I would be a little bit cautious about making an amendment without the legislature's overt agreement to change the budget, but we could evaluate when that was needed and whether a special session would be necessary or whether it could wait a return. And I guess I would want to be sure that the legislature was in agreement.
Nate with SDPB. Governor, there's been a lot of talk, it seems like, each week about Common Core here in South Dakota. First of all, what's your stance on Common Core, and what is your whole perspective of how Common Core has been handled this session?
Okay, I think the question was about Common Core. Common Core standards were adopted by South Dakota in late 2010, so it's been about a little over 3 years or so now that it's been in place. The state has been working to prepare for their implementation. We've spent quite a bit of money, or as I recall, in one bill, $8 million to help train educators on the standards and when a child would supposed to know this and when they're supposed to know that, at which grade, and so on. And I think it's also important to remember that the Common Core state standards were created as a joint effort between the National Governors Association and the chief education officers for the states. That would be like our Melody Shop, our Secretary of Education. In some states, they're elected. Others, they're called different names, but the top education person in each state, they got together and worked up these standards. They were not required or written by the federal government, as some internet chatter suggests. There was no South Dakota funding that was dependent on our adoption of the Common Core state standards, and we have no federal funds that are dependent on that. Again, that's some internet chatter that's not accurate. I do understand and recognize Well, let me back up. First of all, why adopt the Common Core state standards? Well, there's been some lack of progress in academic achievement nationwide. We've seen stagnation in our achievement levels here in South Dakota. We're not getting worse, but we're not getting any better in our academic achievement. And other countries around the world are beginning to pass us in some measures. And so I think there was some concern that our standards weren't rigorous enough. And so we wanted more rigorous standards in math and in the language arts. And the Common Core state standards are an attempt to provide more rigor and more clarity, too. At what level is a child supposed to know what? So that if a child, you know, moves from one school to another as their parents take jobs in other locations, maybe even in other states, there'd be a, if they learn certain multiplication state in third grade, then they would have learned that in third grade at the other school, too. So when they enter fourth grade, they're at the same level as their third grade peers were the prior year. And so that was the intent. And, of course, we want our students to be able to do math, and we want them to have good language arts skills. I know there is some suspicion of the Common Core state standards. Some people see this as a federal intrusion into education. Again, that's born of a belief that the federal government is driving this and enforcing it. Some people worry about student privacy and will individual student data become available. Some people worry that the federal government is intruding into local control, and I share those concerns and I understand them. And so I do think there's been legislative response in some ways. We've got a bill that is aimed very directly at protecting student data, and I think from what I know of it, it's a good bill. I know Secretary Schopp has participated in helping look at that. And I understand there's a bill working through to pause or slow adoption of any further state standards. I'm not aware of the State Board of Education any intent to move on any other standards right now. So I don't see that as threatening. I do think in the end, we should look at these things. We should remember, too, the difference between Common Core state standards and curriculum, because language is often mixed up. Curriculum is the books that you use, whether you use the internet or not. If a teacher brings his or her own materials to class, do you use workbooks or worksheets, or do you use tablets? All those things are curriculum decisions, and those are fully within the control of the local school boards, the school administrators, and the teachers. The Common Core does not dictate that. So to those people who are fearful of it because they think it does dictate that, they're misinformed. And so those curriculum decisions are still fully within the purview of the local school districts, and I believe they should remain there.
Governor, just to clarify what you said earlier, you said you hadn't received any word back on your waiver request. That includes official and unofficial responses?
Neither official nor unofficial. Right. We have not heard. And it is still early. You know, they've had it maybe, 15, 20 working days. So in the world of the federal government, that's like a hypersecond, right?
My understanding is
a nanosecond.
When you explained that you were signing this waiver, you focused on the 100% of poverty request.
Right.
I understand there was also interest in potential work requirements, and I think maybe that interest is even higher among some of the legislators. Is it fair to say that the 100% thing is what you're primarily interested in? That, I mean, if the Fed said, yes, you can do the partial expansion, but you can't do a work requirement, would that satisfy you? Or?
Well, I would have to visit with the legislature about that. Again, I think this is a decision that I should not unilaterally make. I don't think it's mine to make unilaterally. I'm happy that I have a part in the decision to be made, but I do think the legislature needs to play a part as well. So I would want to visit with the legislature about that.
Do you have any questions on the line?
Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Yes, Tony.
Quick question. As you're going through, you're signing bills, Is there anything that you're seeing, any discussion items that you're seeing as far as possible bills that could have come across your desk, or any that have already, that you are saying right now that you cannot accept in any way, shape, or form?
There's nothing that I know of right now that I believe will reach my desk in a form that I would veto right now. I think there are some bills that I don't like, some bills that I have aspects I don't like, but I think the process is still ongoing, and I'm hopeful that if those bills reach my desk, they will be in a form that I can support. So I really can't identify, and I don't want to go into specifics because I don't want to lay down any ultimatums to any legislator through the media.
Are you pleased that you haven't seen any bills? Some bills that may have done things like in Arizona, which was vetoed yesterday, as far as providing businesses, services to certain people, same-sex marriages.
Right.
Are you happy that type of bill was ultimately taken care of within the legislature and did not go any farther?
Yes. I think that was an effort to solve a problem we don't have.
Thank you.
Yes.
Cassie Bartlett, SDPB.
Yes.
There are two texting while driving bills in, one in each chamber. Not sure, how much you've looked into those, but is there one that you would prefer over the other? And do you have any insight on possibly how the conference committee would work out the differences between the fine amount and the municipality control?
Yes, I would probably be supportive of either version. I do philosophically, I think it would be easier for consumers or for drivers if there was uniformity, statewide uniformity, rather than having some variation. At the same time, if all are essentially prohibitions, so the driver knows how to behave, knows the expected behavior, and there's variance just driven by levels of fine or whether it's primary or secondary, I think that gives the driver enough understanding of what is expected that they could be in compliance without knowing the particulars of does this city have this rule or this city have that rule. They would still know that if they want to stay out of trouble, they just don't text. And I think it is important to recognize it from the standpoint of the driver. I was talking to someone just this week who is in California, and if I understood them correctly, this person was talking on their phone while driving, and apparently that's illegal where he was, and I don't know if it's a city ordinance or if it's a state law or what, but of course he didn't know that, and that was the first thing he told the officer who stopped him, said, "Officer, I'm from South Dakota, and we can talk on our phones there, and I didn't know I was breaking the law." And he checked that he was indeed from South Dakota, and he checked that indeed that was the law in South Dakota. The law enforcement officer went back to his vehicle to check that. And then when he came back, he confirmed, "Well, yes, sir, I did check, and that truly is the law in South Dakota. I'm just going to give you a warning." But I think it just demonstrated to me that we always have to look at this from the vantage point of the driver and help them comply with the law, not make it too tough by too much variability. That's a problem that we have right now in the current state of the affairs, where some cities have outlawed it and others have not. And I don't know that your drivers who drive around the state and enter and exit different cities aren't going to know.
Do you have any other questions?
Jet?
Some members of the legislature have said that revenue estimates so far don't look that good. Some of the decisions that will be made in the next couple of weeks obviously would be whether to give extra money to school districts and Medicaid providers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first, I think it's important to remember that I'm proposing to give schools and Medicaid providers about double what the law would typically provide. And so I think, and that is something that I'm able to achieve only by taking some pretty extraordinary measures that would be unusual in a state budget, paying down a significant amount of debt, avoiding other debt, things like that, pre-funding of the Building South Dakota program. All those things involve unusual measures that are designed to create the opportunity to double that funding. And so it's not as if that is the easy path. I haven't taken the path of least resistance in some ways. The second thing I think to remember is the revenue numbers that we have to date and that the legislators are talking about are all backward-looking. These are truly not revenue estimates in the sense that they are not projections of what the revenue will be for the rest of this fiscal year, nor for fiscal year 15. And to achieve that, it's to achieve the projections or the revenue estimates upon which the budget is based, there are two processes that are employed. Once we have as much history as possible, which is what they're talking about, history, and then we also utilize in the LRC methodology, they use trend line projections. So they take that history and project the trends using the lines that are established by that history. They'll have some discussions with the Bureau of Finance and Management to uncover any aberrant or unique situations that would recommend against a perfect alignment with the trend line. But they'll generally use trend line analysis. The Bureau of Finance and Management, on the other hand, takes that history and then uses a pretty complicated algorithm that looks at non-farm employment growth, other economic factors that are not borne out by simple number of revenue dollars. And they'll also be informed by the Bureau or by the Council of Economic Advisors, which just met last week. And they will employ that algorithm then to project revenue estimates in the future. And they've used that algorithm and adjusted it year after year in lots of different economic circumstances. So it's a pretty good mathematical tool that projects. So we don't have a revenue estimate yet. All we have is history so far. And so I think they're talking about the history is not as rosy as maybe it might be, but nor is it especially discouraging either. In the best world, of course, we'd want the historical revenue to demonstrate growth well beyond what our assumptions had been, and then we know there'd be money left on the bottom line and likelihood of a rosy projection. But right now, it's hewing fairly close to projections that were made last year in the actual history. Again, that has to be informed by non-farm employment growth and other economic numbers that are used in that algorithm. So it's too early to say. That's kind of a long answer, but I think it's important to understand the difference.
All right. Thank you all very much.
All right. Thanks, everyone.